holding it against the table and selecting one of the many strange and sharp medical devices, scalpels for all species, on the table next to the scanner. He spoke to the jackal in basic Sangheili, checking the screen before spraying her skin with analgesic spray and then slicing into her arm without preamble. "You speak Covenant," she said with a tight smile, as he made a neat cut into her skin before reaching for a pair of tweezers, the ends of which he stuck into the wound.
"Very little."
"Nora doesn't usually employ humans." He opened the tweezers inside the wound and grabbed hold of the silicone bug implanted just below her skin. She thought back to a moment during her time with Han when she might have felt a tiny sting, but in all the tension and drama, she couldn't place exactly when the bug had been inserted or by whom.
"No, she doesn't," the young man answered. "But things started to get messy when she installed the scanner. Jackals aren't great at being delicate, if you get my meaning. She got tired of all the blood and the customers complaining."
He pulled a tiny gray device the size of a rice grain free and dropped it into a pan.
"Looks like Oni tech," he said, peering at it for a moment. "Seeing more and more of them these days. Advanced little buggers."
He pressed a seal onto her wound. "You're pretty good at this," she said, holding the seal tightly so it would bond to her skin.
"I work at the clinic in New Tyne," he said with a shrug. "At least the complaints here have gone down."
"Would you mind scanning me again?"
"Sure."
By the time they were finished and everyone was bug-free and sealed up, Ryan finally felt a measure of relief. The jackal led them to Nora's door. It slid open a fraction, and Nora Fell stuck her head out. Her beady yellow eyes studied them intently over a long, toothy beak.
"What you doing lurking out here?"
She spied Ryan's seal and snorted.
"Come inside."
She noticed Ram at the back of the pack and gave a surprised squawk.
"You two, working together."
She cackled at that as she moved aside to let them both in, then held up a clawed hand to Lessa and Nico.
"Hatchling, stay."
Nora then proceeded to close the door in their faces. Her clawed feet tapped over the floor as she waddled around her desk and took a seat. Her bling was heavy on the rings today, flashing as she rested her leathery elbows on the desktop, and then propped her lower beak on the teepee of her bejeweled claws. Her eyes were near slits as she regarded Ryan.
"Trouble follows you, Ryan Forge, ever since Aero."
"I need to borrow your sweeper and software for my ship."
"Fine, fine."
She tapped a claw on the table as she thought.
"Oni coming around, asking things."
The feathers that ran down the back of her head and neck stiffened. It was clear she despised them.
"Sticking beaks in business not they own. Despicable. And Geklar, ha! Wants you dead for what you gave him. All trouble Nor does not need."
"Well, I'm not on anyone's radar anymore. Gek is in uncharted space, if I had to guess. And Oni got what they wanted, so..." Ryan rose to leave.
"Sit!"
Nor waited until Ryan complied.
"Your warehouse outside of town, all gone. Came in with ship and lifted it up, away. Nothing left but foundation. But I save you something. I know things ahead of time. So I go and do you another favor. See now, it is you owes me three now."
Ryan's brow lifted, and she couldn't help but be intrigued.
"That depends on what you saved."
"That safe of yours, no cracking it," Nora laughed. "But I go through your things. Find this."
She pulled a small data core from her drawer and set it on the table. Nora's smile was more of an open-mouthed pant, but Ryan was familiar with the sight of the Kigyar grin.
"Why this pricey thing not in your safe?"
Ryan knew exactly why. Because Nico had begged to study it before they put it on the market. Nor hadn't had to dig very deep. Ryan was pretty sure the core had been left front and center on Nico's work table. Any other time, she'd be livid at him for not storing it before they left. But Ryan wasn't about to look a gift horse in the mouth.
"What do you want for it?"
Nora touched a claw to the top of the core and pushed it across the desk, where it came to rest in front of Ryan.
"Saving my favors. Take it."
Whatever Nora had in store for her, Ryan knew she'd pay the price later. She agreed to owe another favor, and left Nora's with a data core containing a salvaged dumb AI, a completely functioning mining facility superintendent. It was worth a small fortune. Outside the city, where the roads were still dirt and the neighbors few and far between, Ryan sat on the tailgate of her truck with Ram and Lessa, parked on a rise overlooking the small commercial lot where her shipping container once sat. Nico stood on the side of the road, looking at the sight with his fingers linked and resting on top of his head.
Well, Lessa said with a sigh. Nora wasn't kidding, was she?
It had made a lovely warehouse once upon a time. Nearly 400 square meters of space gone. Ryan hadn't needed more room than that. The big salvage was always dumped at the clearinghouse, so there had been plenty of room for small-scale acquisitions, a workspace, and her office, which boasted a very pricey Bernard MK2, where she'd kept a copy of Little Bit's projections for the Spirit of Fire. But paying the best for one of the most uncrackable safes in the galaxy didn't mean much when someone could simply fly over and lift her entire business up off the ground and steal away with whatever was inside. Seeing the foundation solidified the enormity of what Oni had taken from her. Her search for her father might have just come to a permanent end, along with her job and livelihood. Nico dropped his hands and kicked the small rocks on the side of the road, watching them bounce down the hill.
This is bullshit! They can't just take everything.
They already did, Nico, Ryan said. Lessa hopped off the tailgate and put a hand on her brother's shoulder. As they stared at the vacant lot, Ryan knew the reality was settling in for them as well. She wasn't the only one with irreplaceable items stored inside the missing container. Nico shrugged Lessa's comforting hand away.
How can they get away with this? Who do they think they are?
They think they're protecting humanity, Lessa said, shoving her hands in her pockets. Nico turned around.
How can you say that? They don't care about humanity. They care who's in charge. Oni did it because they can. This is all a big power trip. They couldn't give a rat's ass about us.
I'm not defending them, she replied, frowning. I just lost all my stuff too, you know.
Oh, what? You lost your knitting needles and your wool? Big deal.
Lessa flinched. No, Nico... We lost everything we took from Alaria. Nico shook his head. It was clear he didn't want to fight with his sister, but his emotions were overwhelming him, and he couldn't seem to help it.
We didn't have anything to take, Les. We left Alaria with a bag of shitty clothes. There was nothing of value from that life worth saving. Nothing at all.
Her eyes went round and hurt. She blinked a few times, trying not to cry.
There was Mom's stuff. Her blanket and her...
He rolled his eyes.
Oh, come on. You never knew her, Lessa. That stuff they gave you at the shelter, that could have belonged to anyone. You just believed what they told you because you wanted it to be true. Why do you think we don't even have a last name? Because no one knew who our parents were.
They were standing toe to toe, Ryan perched on the tailgate, ready to intervene if necessary. Lessa's lips thinned, and her round face was pale and utterly stricken. Suddenly, she shoved Nico in the chest so hard that he ended up in the dirt on his rear end. As she stormed off down the road, he sat up and watched her go with a mixture of anger and regret and hurt, about to call her back. But the words didn't come. So he gave up, lying back in the dirt and letting out a frustrated groan. Ram remained quiet next to Ryan for a moment, picking at his fingernails.
You want me to go get her?
No, let her cool off a while. Ryan gave him a flat smile.
Bet you didn't expect all this when you asked to crew with us. What is it they say? Be careful what you wish for.
Well, I was looking for a distraction.
His dry humor crinkled the corners of his dark eyes. He had a lot of lines there, permanent evidence of his good nature. Ryan watched Lessa marching farther away and let out a deep sigh. She hopped off the tailgate and walked over to stare down at Nico. He felt her gaze and removed his hands from his face.
If you're going to lecture me, don't bother.
Wouldn't dream of it.
Right. You always lecture me. Just leave me here. I've decided this is where I'm going to stay until I die.
Oh, boy. She kicked the sole of his boot.
Get up.
He scowled, and she kicked him again.
Get up.
Go get your sister.
We have work to do.
30 minutes later, they were all sitting at a corner table in a busy bistro bar in downtown New Tyne. The mood was somber. Nico and Lessa weren't speaking to or looking at each other, and Ram wasn't quite sure how to interact, so he stayed quiet. After the waiter left, Ryan dug into her jacket pocket, pulled out the small core, and placed it on the table. Now she had their interest. Here's where things stand. Oni now has the location of the debris field. They've either apprehended Geklar by now or they're fighting over the field as we speak. They have Little Bit. She drew in a deep breath. And they confiscated all his clips and projections of my father and the Spirit of Fire. They didn't just take our warehouse here. They took them all, along with all of our bank accounts. We have zero leverage and everything we've worked for is gone. Ryan let that sink in for all of 3 seconds before diving into the rest of her speech. So here's what we're going to do. Nico, you're going to meet Nora's people at the airfield and use her software and sweeper to clean the ship. Top to bottom. Once it's clear, you're going to do it again. Les, you're going to contact Rouse at Tiny Birds and ask him to do a quick sale on this core. He likes you. You can get him to do it for beans. Use half the profit to load us up on fuel cells and food and drink stores. I want Ace packed to capacity. Lessa nodded and pulled the core toward her as Ryan turned her attention to Ram. Ram, she began, I don't know what's in store for us or where we'll end up, so if you want out, I'll completely understand. He held up a hand. I don't jump ship when things get rough. I knew when I signed up that we'd be dodging Oni. Things went a little sideways, sure, he said with a smile at his understatement. But I'm part of your crew now. I'm still in, and Gek is still out there. Whatever you need me to do. Ryan gave him a grateful nod. All right, she said, clearing her throat. You'll take the other half of the core's profits and secure us new star charts, since we scrubbed ours, and then you're going to get Nico the tech he needs to decipher whatever the hell is on this. She reached into her other pocket and laid the augmented glove on the table. I didn't take these off until we left the Prowler. Nico sat straighter, eyes going wide. Wait, you used it on Oni? I did. And if there's anything useful on this scanner, I promise you, we'll use it to take our lives back. We're not out of the game yet.
Chapter 11. Ace of Spades, orbiting Venezia, 5 days later. Nico slapped 2 separate files onto the lounge's center table, directly in front of Ryan. As she sat, eating her breakfast bowl of warm rice mixed with fresh Brillen eggs they picked up from the market in New Tyne.
Well, here it is, he said. A little bit short contribution to what would have been an amazing partnership.
He let out a heavy sigh. Ram peered around from his chair facing the viewscreen, antiquated reading glasses slipping down his nose, while Lessa stayed leaning on the meal counter, cradling her breakfast bowl in her hands and giving her brother a contrite look. Nico slid into the chair next to Ryan, completely invading her personal space. He touched a finger to the document in front of her.
Translated readout from Gexcom, and a whopper from the big Oni dude who grabbed you on Kamoya.
Ryan glanced up at him, mouthful as she asked,
You read them?
He gave her a frown, as though she was crazy for asking.
Now, Gex's last report is a real shocker, he said with sarcasm. He's going to win the auction, lots of religious bullshit, with some dude named Jewel and Dama, and then after he acquires the harvester, he's headed for the debris field to mine, blah, 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 some precious weapon, blah, blah, blah. Same old Covey song and dance. But this, he said, tapping the next report, this is some serious gold.
Ryan wiped her mouth, pushed the bowl aside, and went to pull the document closer to read, but Nico couldn't contain his excitement.
That big dude who nabbed you is a Spartan, he said in a delighted rush. A real-life Spartan. I mean, it fits, right? I'm thinking the lady was too, which makes me feel a whole lot better about being carried across the canal. Anyway, you were right. Their ship is a prowler. The Toro Cado. Only got this one image, but it's a report about some distress call and orders to investigate after securing the debris field and looking around for your dad's ship.
He tapped the file.
Apparently, they think this signal might be related to some redacted/coded incident in 2554.
He pointed to a particular sentence.
Look here. Proceed with extreme caution. High-value asset. Containment protocol BKW-112. Secure access to the site. Do not engage. They even slip-spaced a commsat to the area to block the distress call from reaching anyone else.
Ram had removed his reading glasses, his attention fixed on Nico's revelation. Lessa was listening intently as well. Ryan picked up the document.
So they're protecting their asset from being found. That's promising.
Right? And I'm thinking while they're off saving everyone from Gek and securing our debris field, bastards that they are, we'll skip on over and do a little rescue and recover mission. There's definitely something of value at this site.
Lessa approached.
And then we make a trade for our stuff back.
Exactly, said Nico.
We could get in and out before they have a chance to point in our direction, Ram said, joining them.
May I?
Ryan slid the reports his way. He put his glasses back on.
The Ibicus system. That's a 2 or 3 week hike, give or take.
He typed the system name into the integrated pad on the table. A hollow appeared showing a single star system with 4 small planetary bodies inside a large asteroid belt.
The planet where the signal is being broadcast is here, he said,
pointing at a small sand-colored world closest to its star.
Gyrinos A, it's called. Uninhabited. Gravity weighs in at 0.679 Gs, so we can manage that. Atmosphere is too thin, though.
There should be time, right? Lessa asked.
What do you think? Oni has to get to the debris field, secure it, and then travel to Gyrinos A. The Oni Prowler was a faster ship than Ace, but they should have plenty of time. Still, Ryan didn't want to rush things or make any knee-jerk decisions. Whatever was so valuable on Gyrinos A might be more than they could handle. But then again, they wouldn't know for certain unless they headed out to Ibicus and took a look.
We didn't start it, Nico replied, taking her hesitation for a no-go.
Oni doesn't have to know how we got our hands on their salvage, Lessa said. Just so we came across it somewhere, somehow. We could be there and gone without them even knowing.
Ryan considered their words. They could salvage the site, rescue anyone stranded, leave long before the Torokado arrived, wait a spell, and then auction whatever they'd salvaged at Nors. No doubt, if the asset on Gyrinos A was as important as it seemed to be, Oni would come calling, and when they did, Ryan's price would be the return of all of their confiscated items, plus interest for their troubles if she could swing it.
All right, she said. What's to stop them from forcibly taking our salvage once we have it? They send a Spartan after us or after Nor, and no one will stand a chance.
Silence filled the lounge.
There's a good chance they wouldn't risk angering the Venusian militia, Ram said, and starting a war with the outer colonies.
Nora's clearinghouse worked because she operated within the thin confines of Venusian and UNSC salvage law. If Oni disregarded their own rules for all to see and stormed the clearinghouse, they'd infuriate a lot of very dangerous and well-armed groups who relied on Nor for their goods. Ryan wanted Little Bit's projections. She wanted the video clips of her father. She wanted her credits back, and she wanted Lessa's damn blanket. Still, she hesitated. Losing Cade had changed things. He was always going to be an enormous factor in her decisions from now on. All those stolen items, no matter how much they meant, weren't worth losing another one of her crew. Ryan's head came up, and she saw the understanding in their eyes. They knew what she was thinking without saying a word. Finally, Lessa spoke up, which surprised Ryan because Les was usually the more cautious one in her crew.
Well, it wouldn't hurt if we went out there and took a look around. I mean, we are salvagers.
Universal law says we're legally bound to offer assistance to distress calls, Ram added,
thoughtfully tapping a finger to his lips.
We'd simply be responding to a ship's distress call and helping any survivors. We could render aid, and while we're there, liberate their high-value asset.
Call it an exploratory mission, Nico said.
While the risk weighed on Ryan's mind, she also knew that if they played this right, it might work in their favor. The crew was in accord and waiting for an answer. Beyond sticking it to Oni, there might be more than that valuable asset to be found. She'd just be playing the hand Oni had dealt her, after all. Plus, it would be immensely satisfying to give Oni a taste of what they'd been dishing out to salvagers for years. At the very least, Ryan couldn't deny that wiping that smug look off of Agent Han's face would be extremely satisfying. "We'll need a jump plan and a complete chart of the planet and the system," Ryan said. Lessa's lips drew into a smile, and Ram gave an approving nod. Nico clapped his hands as Ryan pushed up from the table, glanced around at the ace crew, and grinned. "Let's get back to doing what we do best." Chapter 12.
3 of this planet's years have now passed. The cataloging and parsing of my human personality and body pattern is nearly complete. Memories have settled into place, and much of the past now resides in appropriate sectors to be examined at will. My life on Erde Tyrene, my time with the Forerunners, with Bornstellar and the Librarian, with my human friends, Riser, Venevra, and Gamelpar. The long responsibility as monitor of Installation 04. And the rather disastrous meeting with modern humans after millennia of separation. There are gaps, of course, more recent than not. Damage done. Things lost. And things that remain, whether I wish them to or not. I reflect often on the past. I ponder who and what I am, and what I will become. The lines between good decisions and bad ones are blurred. They meet and diverge like star roads, in constant motion, stretching and tangling and affecting things seen and unseen. I travel these roads through the detached lens of a visitor to an ancient history, but the lens does not diminish the regret, the pride, the loss, and the horror of those final days of the Great War that took place between the Forerunners and the Flood, and my part in it. Part savior, I did exemplary work in my short time aiding the Librarian. Part destroyer, as monitor, I performed my functions well. I was Chaikus. I was 343 Guilty Spark. What am I now? Neither identity is satisfactory any longer, for I am changed. I am less, and I am more. I tuck my alloy hands beneath my metal head and lie back against the giant leaning shard of the Rubicon's aft exterior, which juts up from the sand. It is a good place to study the stars, or simply enjoy the sight of them in the sky. There is no moon or light pollution, so the nights here allow me to see far and deep into space. I raise one knee up, digging my undamaged heel into the sand to brace me, and I spend this night, like many others, staring up and letting memories wash over me. Still a few rogue pieces to put together, compartments to merge. The order of things, at times, confounds me, but I find when I don't try so hard, my memory patterns seem to fall instinctually into the right place. This has taken much practice. Letting go, slowing down my thought processes, allowing my mind to wander. I have not experienced such a thing since I was Chaikus, since I had a physical body and mind, and my days were spent in idle, unfocused, and reckless pursuits. But now, as I gaze up at the stars, letting patterns drift and settle, I have begun to embrace this forgotten part of being human, this reminiscing, roaming, and sensing. My armature body feels nothing, of course, unless I simulate what I believe to be the correct response to external stimuli. And I do, quite often. I laugh, I sing, I hurt, I cry. I let sadness wash over me, the way my human personality pattern remembers it. 100,000 years is a long time to yearn, to miss old friends. What am I becoming? Something, someone free. Free to choose. Is it a luxury, a fundamental right, Or is it a burden, this freedom? I hum. I enjoy this function most of all. Vibration spreads through my updated vocal cords, and my being fills with melody. I remember how much I desired, at one point in my existence, to be human again. Now, however, I am beginning to conclude that humanity can mean more than simple biology, more than cells and sinew and bone. It is the consciousness as well. And that aspect is something I still, in a manner of speaking, possess. I have no wish for a physical existence. At least, not yet. This form will do until I have fulfilled my purpose. A meteor flares and then trails across the blackness of space, flickering out as though it was never there to begin with. Gone. That is the span of a human life. A bright, burning, silent burst. A flicker, a gasp. Then nothing more. But other things persist, from one age to the next, defying the laws of nature, refusing to forget. In this, I am not alone.
Chapter 13. Facility at Voi, Kenya, Africa, Earth, June 2557. Annabelle Richards, former head of ONI Special Operations and current director of Project Bookworm, walked quickly down a man-made corridor. Behind the glossy white walls, floor, and ceiling were kilometers of fiber optics, cables, and reverse-engineered forerunner technology, an elaborate and sophisticated labyrinth designed to trap, confound, and essentially cut off an artificial intelligence from the rest of the galaxy. But not just any AI. This place had been designed and built to hold one very dangerous and elusive intelligence. Should they ever find him? If there was anything to find. When Annabelle had received word that the ONI commissioned research vessel UNSC Rubicon was broadcasting a distress signal from an uninhabited planet in the Ibaka system after 3 years lost, she'd sat back in her chair and stared at the top secret missive in shock. So surprised, in fact, that the facility AI, Ferguson, had appeared on her desk with a medical alert, noting her sharp rise in blood pressure. A cargo ship had picked up the faint signal a few weeks earlier, and because the signal indicated a military vessel, the captain had passed along the information to the authorities. Once the intel reached her, Annabelle had taken over. Unfortunately, the timing couldn't have been worse, as her team had been out on maneuvers. But she'd found the closest ONI vessel in the sector, the Torokado, and ordered them to secure the site for her team once their current mission was complete. Once the Torokado made it to Gyranos A, they would stay in orbit, with strict orders to avoid contact or engagement of any kind with the surface. If Guilty Spark, by some miracle, was still with the Rubicon, care must be taken. Now that her team had returned from maneuvers on Titan, Annabelle felt a small measure of calm. As she stopped at the end of the corridor and scanned her security clearance to open the elevator door, her nerves were firing in a million different directions. They'd been waiting and hoping for a break like this, and there were many times during her short tenure when she had wondered if all the preparation and effort of the last year and a half would be for nothing. Project Bookworm might finally be able to do the work for which it was created. Interview, interrogate, and study the ancient forerunner monitor, 343 Guilty Spark. At the heart of Bookworm were two of the most highly classified and important pieces of data ONI had ever recovered. One was found on the shield world Onyx by Hugo Barton and his research team in the spring of 2554. Known as the Born-Stellar Relation, it was an ancient forerunner testimony detailing the key players in the forerunner flood war and the galaxy-wide firing of the Halo Array. The other was a data drop recovered from deep space in late 2555. While the exact date of the drop was unknown, it had been ejected by someone or something on the Rubicon. The data contained an autobiographical account given by 343 Guilty Spark to the Rubicon crew, which mirrored events in the Born-Stellar Relation. It was shortly after this discovery that Bookworm came into being. These combined accounts had provided incredible insight into Forerunner civilization, their customs, biology, rates, technology, and history, as well as their final days fighting the Flood, ruthless and invasive parasitic organisms whose sole purpose was the consumption of all sentient life in the galaxy. Nearly 100,000 years ago, in a last-ditch effort to defeat the Flood, the Forerunners had created Halo, massive ring-shaped weapons designed to fire simultaneously and purge all sentient life from the Milky Way galaxy, in essence starving the Flood of its food source and wiping the slate clean. Meanwhile, the Ark stood outside the galaxy, ready and waiting to reseed life once the Flood was finally dead and gone. Annabelle's job as director was to compartmentalize information between divisions so that no one knew the full scope of the project, while coordinating the effort to find Guilty Spark, to study him, and ultimately determine whether the shocking claims in his account were true. And while his testimony had gone through dozens of translations, which were then continually run through Oni's advanced statistical AIs, statbots, whose sole function was to analyze and predict probabilities and casualties based on the text, there were questions left unanswered, things that didn't add up, and eventualities they had to prepare for. They'd learned many things from the Forerunners and their incredible technology. There were personnel here chomping at the bit to study the monitor, to see how it had survived as long as it had without devolving into complete rampancy. Finding that answer might increase the longevity of humanity's own smart AIs, but Annabelle felt somewhat differently. Every monitor, every ship, every bit of ancient technology was inherently dangerous. They were weapons that had to be contained. The numbers of lives lost on the Halo rings, on the Ark, and, of course, during and after the Covenant War, were astronomical. 2 years had passed since Operation Farstorm. She'd been part of that mission, and had seen firsthand the devastation and destruction wreaked by rogue and rampant AIs. Even the ancient Forerunner tales themselves, in the wrong hands, could lead to disaster. As the elevator neared the surface, where the facility boasted its own airfield, two hangars, a comm tower, and personnel quarters, Annabelle drew in a deep breath, squared her shoulders, tugged her jacket straight, and then shoved an errant strand of red hair behind her ear, where it belonged. The elevator stopped, the door slid open, and the quiet hum of her small space evaporated. The tarmac was full of life and noise. The scent of clay and dry grass, mixed with jet fuel and exhaust, met her as she stepped outside. A hefty dose of hot savanna wind blew her sleek hair into a frenzy. "Damn it," she muttered at her forgetfulness, pulling a small band from her uniform pocket and tying her hair back quickly, before heading across the tarmac to the large, angular shape of the Eclipse-class prowler, Bad Moon Rising. A fit figure in a black flight suit emerged from beneath the enormous black wing. There was no mistaking the captain of the Bad Moon Rising. He was a formidable presence, a lifelong military man, a veteran with a list of war medals 100 meters long and a classified file even longer. His hair was as black as the ship he commanded, but graying at his temples, which Annabelle thought gave him a very distinguished air.
"Captain Hollier, how were maneuvers?"
The captain held out a hand to escort her away from the ship and the loud whirring of its powerful engines. Behind him, the hangar bay was being loaded with supplies for their journey to the Ibaka system. Once he could speak without shouting, he gave her a perfunctory smile.
"Maneuvers were excellent, Director."
Annabelle should have been used to that title by now. Her military rank was that of captain, but for the tenure of this project, she was referred to as Director, and it sounded odd every time she heard it.
"Gear is already on board," Hollier continued. "We're just loading up supplies, and then we'll be ready to go."
"You've been briefed?"
"Yes, ma'am. Ferg briefed us on the way in."
While knowledge of the project was heavily compartmentalized, Hollier knew enough details to allow him to thoroughly complete his mission, to investigate the source of the signal and contain any remains of a Forerunner AI thought to be on board for study.
"The containment chamber?"
"In working order."
"Good. I don't need to explain how important this is."
They'd had many discussions about the mission, many trials and maneuvers and simulations, to to prepare them for an eventuality that might never come. And while Annabelle had complete belief in Captain Hollier and his team, she still needed 100% reassurance.
"No, ma'am, you do not,"
he replied evenly, and she appreciated his calm demeanor and understanding more than ever.
"We're ready. We'll bring back your asset and we'll bring it back contained."
"See that you do." He gave her a crisp nod and then turned to go.
"Captain," she called.
He paused, turning back around.
"Be careful out there."
He dipped his head and then walked toward his ship as a large helping of guilt settled into her stomach, curling into a tight little knot, which would certainly stay there until they returned. The 6-member asset recovery team, or AR team as Annabelle called it, of the Bad Moon Rising strode across the tarmac and met up with Hollier, falling in line, duffels on their backs and looking ready for anything. A black patch with a white wolf in mid-howl was sewn onto the shoulder of each flight suit. No name tags, no military designations, just the Howler, in honor of the ship and captain they served. Annabelle had selected the personnel carefully, finding the perfect candidates in Hollier's team. They'd been pulled years ago from elite special ops forces across the UNSC and within ONI's Delta VI candidate pool. Each member was highly skilled in the art of asset and artifact retrieval, which covered a wide range of skill sets: reconnaissance, direct action, unconventional warfare, counterintelligence, and more. They'd received training by specialists from REAP-X and XCG to identify, decipher, and handle Forerunner technology and artifacts, as well as the latest tech in reverse engineering and xenoarchaeology. In short, they were highly trained combat specialists who could function effectively as Forerunner artifact hunters, able to navigate any number of hostile worlds and environments. They were also a tight-knit group who had cut their teeth as a squad on previous projects, facing high-risk scenarios and impossible situations in the harshest of places. In addition to the 6 ARs and the captain, there were 2 supporting staff members, a trauma medic and Thea, a smart AI with complete knowledge of Bookworm's purpose. The ramp began to close, and Annabelle sent a silent prayer for success. Failure wasn't an option. If Guilty Spark was found intact and operational, and her team's attempt at containment failed, if he tried to take over the Bad Moon Rising the way he had the Rubicon, the Prowler would begin a hard self-destruct sequence. ONI couldn't risk this particular rogue intelligence running rampant across the galaxy with a Prowler at his disposal. The team knew the risks, but these weren't ordinary people. They weren't even ordinary soldiers. They believed in their training and their capabilities. They might be from all different backgrounds, but they had one key thing in common. They had no ties, no family, no one to miss them if they didn't return, and most importantly, no one who could compromise their judgment and prevent them from completing the task at hand. Their only bond was to the mission, to one another, and to Annabelle. That was it. It might have been a terrible way to choose a team, but Operation Farstorm, those lost on the Ark and the numerous casualties here in Kenya, as Home Fleet defended against the Ark's retriever sentinels, still weighed heavily on Annabelle's mind and heart. She'd never forget returning home from the Ark to find such destruction and casualties strewn across the savannah. Being in charge, holding others' fates in her hands, hadn't been easy then, nor was it now. With a heavy sigh, she headed across the tarmac to where Bookworm's head of xenoarchaeology, Dr. William Iqbal, waited for her.
"Doctor," she greeted him.
"Come to see them off?"
The wind ruffled his graying hair as Bad Moon Rising prepared for lift, its thrusters maneuvering for the push off the tarmac. The dark ship ascended, rising steadily into the air.
"Godspeed to them," the doctor said, hands tucked into his tan trousers, staring up through thick glasses as the Prowler increased its acceleration and shot up into the sky.
He didn't need the glasses, not with today's advances, but like many scholars, he held onto old traditions. She opened her mouth to inquire about preparedness, but he was expecting it.
"Don't worry, Annabelle. We're ready for this. All the teams are standing by."
Annabelle regarded the darkening sky. With only the distress call containing the Rubicon's transponder codes and location, they didn't have much to go on. There was no way to tell if the ship had crashed, if there were survivors, if Guilty Spark was still with them, or damaged, or long gone.
You were still worried,
William said, looking at her in that studious way of his. Of course I'm worried. You've read the Statbot's evaluations. You know there's a chance. If he's out there, if he's on Gyrinos A with the Rubicon, that this might be exactly what he wants. You've read his account. You know as well as I do what he's after. Or rather, whom he's after. He wants to come to Earth, William. I'm sure of it. And I can assure you, he has no desire to do so in our custody.
Guilty Spark could very well be among the most dangerous and singular minds in the entire galaxy.
Well, we'll know soon enough. William's hand squeezed her shoulder.
If he's there, the pod will hold him, Annabelle. We've learned from our mistakes with Intrepid Eye. We're prepared.
Maybe. Hopefully. And the Statbot's analysis?
What about it?
Guilty Spark's story, do you still agree with their conclusions?
I do. 343 Guilty Spark is an unreliable narrator with an unclear motive for relating his tale.
Unfortunately, that was exactly what she thought too. And God only knew what that true motive was.
Chapter 14. UNSC Torokado, Debris Field, Corinth Prior System, June 8, 2557. With the cooperation of Ryan Forge's fragmented AI, the Torokado had been able to locate the debris field without incident. If they played this right, they might even catch Jewel and Dama's second-in-command, Geklar, and his newly acquired harvester. Fireteam Apollo leader Spartan Novak was determined to remove the Sangheili commander from the game board for good. Captain Kara stood across the tactical table, monitoring the feed from the drones as they hovered low over Site 037, a large chunk of Forerunner construction embedded in rock. Almost as soon as the drones began their coordinated grid pattern, Novak saw something on the surface.
Looks like battle plating. Turk, can you magnify?
One of the drones descended and increased magnification.
That's definitely UNSC plating, Captain Kara agreed.
The more evidence, the better, Novak thought, as the drone recorded the location and then continued on, searching for more. They already knew, thanks to information gleaned from Little Bit, the name given to the fragmented AI recovered by the ACE crew, that the Spirit of Fire had been on the Forerunner world. A shield world of all things, the fragment had said. Novak had never dreamed the fragment would possess such startling intel. They'd watched actual video footage of Sergeant John Forge and witnessed the brief fight between Red Team and the Elites. And they'd learned just how the ship had defeated the Covenant and destroyed the shield world. Novak had watched the feed along with those on the bridge, and for a long time, no one spoke. Forge's final mission was of the highest order, the stuff of heroes and legend. There was a very good likelihood that his sacrifice in the crew's efforts had saved humanity. Had the Covenant gotten its hands on the Forerunner battle fleet stationed on the shield world, and all the technology the world itself contained, the war would have been over in a heartbeat. The Discovery breathed new life into the search for the lost vessel. They now knew why the ship couldn't make its way home. Using their slipspace drive to blow up the shield world was ingenious, but it had also taken away the Spirit's ability to jump. So they drifted, lost in uncharted space. 11,000 brave souls. They could be anywhere, settled on a planet, in cryo. It didn't sit well with him, after all the crew had done and sacrificed. The idea that they might still be out there somewhere, hoping for rescue, that his Spartan brethren on Red Team were MIA. Novak crossed to the viewscreen and regarded the debris field, the scale of it, the enormity of what the Spirit of Fire had accomplished, as Ryan Forge's words rang in his head. She was right. They'd failed them. For 26 years, they'd failed to bring them home. As the drones moved on, scanning, recording, sampling, Captain Kara joined him at the viewscreen.
What do you think, Spartan? Think they're still out there?
He thought again of the video files they'd retrieved from Little Bit and of Ryan's father. Novak had read the man's file with interest. Some hair-raising moments, for sure, but a die-hard Marine who got the job done. Novak could see where his daughter got her medal, and her insolence. And as a former Marine himself, he hadn't liked taking Ryan's memories from her. Hell, he didn't like keeping this new discovery from the families even now. But that wasn't his call to make.
Yes, I believe they're still out there, he answered.
They had to be.
Turk, how are those calculations coming? The captain asked.
The fragment's path projections are correct. I'm running it through applicable Forerunner star charts, speed, time, variables. Captain,
he paused, a warning tone entering his voice.
One of the drones is recording evidence of flood contamination. Collecting samples now.
Turk stared off into space as he commanded the fleet of drones sent out to explore several sites within the debris. They'd record video, take high-res images, and gather samples, so Hugo Barton and his team could ascertain the validity of setting up a research facility here in the field. Suddenly, an alert blared through the bridge.
Captain, we have enemy contact, Turk said.
On screen, battle stations.
As the Torokado proceeded around a vast section of debris, they came face to face with a small Covenant battle group. The Torokado was a prowler, designed for stealth recon and incursions. As fast and advanced as she wasn't equipped with the firepower they'd need to engage a battle group.
Evasive actions, Kara said, with a note of reluctance. Spartan, think you can distract them long enough for us to recover the drones and drop a buoy they won't detect?
Not a problem.
He pressed his fireteam comm channel.
Apollo, suit up. Deployment bay in 5.
He turned to Turk.
Have the techs prep the broadswords.
I'm on it.
Novak strode from the bridge and headed for the deployment bay, where he met his team, a pair of Spartan 4s, Adam Sarah and Danelle Reed, assigned to the Torokado a month prior. 3 was small for a team, but Apollo was transient, without a static roster, forming and reforming depending on need and mission. As a result, those assigned to Apollo were chosen for their heightened ability to quickly adapt to one another and to any situation. The 3 of them went to work, and in minutes were streaking from the prowler to play chicken with the battle group. The enemy stayed in position while one of the destroyers launched a pair of Seraphs. Almost immediately, the hunting pair latched onto Novak's tail. He banked the F-41 broadsword right, punched thrusters, and dove beneath a colossal chunk of mountain range. When he came out the other side, Reed closed in on his 3 o'clock. As soon as he was clear, she blasted the mountain, raining debris onto the pursuing Seraph, causing it to smash into the scaffolding of a substructure that Novak missed by mere meters as Sarah drew the other Seraph off. As he piloted up and over a massive island with clear Forerunner ruins and Covenant activity on the ground, Novak hit his comms.
Captain, you seeing this?
There was the damn harvester, crouched like some enormous beetle, firing an intense beam of plasma into the surface rock and creating a plume of illuminated dust.
Affirmative, Spartan.
Well, now we know why the group's not giving chase, Spartan Sarah said through comms.
They're protecting the site, Reed said. Then, Novak, you've got 1 on your 6, and looks like we got another pair incoming.
I got him.
The Seraph dropped down behind Novak, twin plasma bolts sailing just past his wing as he banked, and then dove the broadsword through a rift in an enormous piece of Forerunner infrastructure. A giant section of scaffolding the size of an orbital defense platform, with large chunks of terraformed surface still clinging to the outer portions of the metal. Despite the obstacles, the Seraph stuck close as they wove in and out of rock and metal. Damn, the bird was hard to shake. Turk's voice came over comms.
Drones on board and buoy dropped. Fireteam Apollo, you are clear to return.
Damn, and I was just getting warmed up, Reed said, coming in hot behind the Seraph.
All right, you heard him, Novak said, smiling. Apollo, let's smoke these losers.
Chapter 15 Ace of Spades, Slipspace to Ibaka's System. The most boring part of space travel, in Nico's opinion, was slipspace. Nothing to see, no stops along the way, spotty communication with his chatter buddies and his group of friends back on Venezia. Plus, Cap always used the downtime to make them repair or clean something, or catalog salvaged parts in the hold. Since there was nothing currently in the hold, cleaning had taken precedence.
And so the time since they'd left Venezia had taken on the monotonous cycle of wake, work out, shower, eat, clean, sleep. All made worse by the fact that he and Lessa were still at odds. The ghost of Cade seemed to lurk everywhere, and Nico had lost everything that usually made the long trips bearable, his work. He pulled on his flight suit, then splashed water on his face and cleaned his teeth, dragged his fingers through his unruly hair, and eyed his tired face in the small mirror. He scratched at the overgrown stubble on his jaw, knowing he should shave, but too damn tired or bored or angry to give a damn. He wasn't sure which. The Oni bastards had invaded his personal space and taken everything, all his notes, his projects and models, his files and research. His workstation had been thoroughly cleaned. But he missed a little bit, most of all, the things he and LB could have accomplished. With that AI fragment, he'd had a taste of true technological majesty, and then it was gone, like the mythical creature it was. The only thing the spooks hadn't taken was his memory, and Nico remembered every story LB had told, every account of the past and technological information that had slipped through his fragmented core. Outrageous tales, unbelievable bits of data, strange things, amazing things. And man, the stuff Nico had learned. His gaze settled on the photographs he'd pinned to the board above his workstation. He was surprised Oni had left them behind, but he was sure glad they had. On that board was everyone he loved, mostly candid shots, taken on the ship and at salvage sites and R&R stops along the way. For a little while, they'd been a happy unit, a loud, argumentative, happy family, or what he always imagined a family was like, anyway. Cade had died in that debris field, and for what? With little bit, Nico could console himself with the lofty idea that they might do something great, something that benefited the entire galaxy, the civvies, the little guys, those stuck on dirty worlds ruled by dirty politicians and thugs, something that would make Cade's death serve a higher purpose, or have some deeper meaning, make it somehow better. Stupid idea. Nothing would make it better. Cade McDonough was the only man Nico had ever known who hadn't exploited him, hit him, or ignored him. Nico had learned that a person could be strong and capable and inspire loyalty without instilling fear. And man, how he had tried to get a rise out of Cade, to test him, to see if he was like the others back on Alaria. He'd been afraid to believe in someone like Cade. Yet somewhere along the way, he'd begun to trust that it was no act. Cade never told you what kind of man he was. He showed you. And goddammit, he missed the hell out of him. Nico wiped at the sting in his eyes and gave the pictures another look before leaving the room. He didn't know his mother or his father. Never would. But Ryan and Cade had been the closest he'd ever get, and the loss burned inside him. And yeah, he'd taken some of his anger out on Lessa, who stubbornly clung to a past that didn't deserve her efforts. While she should be grieving for the person who had been there, who actually had given a damn. He didn't like to think about it, but now, thanks to the joys of slipspace and Oni spooks, there wasn't much else to keep his mind occupied. He despised cleaning and working out and watching whatever holovid Lessa had programmed into the ship's entertainment system. He didn't like the things he'd said to his sister, and he wasn't sure how to fix the rift he'd caused. And if he walked into the lounge one more time and saw her and Ram playing that stupid Sangheili board game again, like nothing was wrong, he might just scream. He stopped outside the gym and checked the systems panel on the wall. Another 8 days of slipspace travel left. He didn't know how he was going to get through it. The best part of space travel, in Les's opinion, was slipspace. She loved the quiet, the time to do laundry, clean out her quarters, studied star charts and navigational techniques, knit or paint or dye colored stripes into her frizzy blonde hair. As she sat on her bed, applying her favorite cerulean blue polymer to her toenails with her old UV paint pen, a sudden wave of sadness stilled her hand. Only a short time ago, she could add sparring with Cage to that list. They'd had a standing gym order to train every time Ace entered slipspace. She was stronger, more confident, and sometimes able to fell a man twice her size because of Cade. He'd been a great teacher, calm, relaxed, showing her different moves and techniques and the reason behind them in a manner she, as a novice, could easily understand. She already knew how to fight dirty, but Cade hadn't quelled that knowledge, nor had he made her feel inferior because of it. Instead, he gave her ways to build upon what she'd taught herself. He never made her feel like she'd come from nothing, quite the opposite. He made her feel like she could do anything and become whatever she wanted. She'd put him on a pedestal, but he deserved it. Lessa knew where she came from, and was well aware there was an emptiness inside her where parents should have been, where anyone who gave a damn should have been. Ryan and Cade had filled that space. Les had never expected to lose one of them so soon. In fact, it had never really crossed her mind. And now Cade was gone, and she wasn't quite sure how to deal with the loss. Except, apparently, to argue with her brother. She rolled her eyes, finished the color application, and then flopped back on her bed to stare at the ceiling. It was plastered with old star charts. Odd, that. She never thought she'd like space and navigation so much. In fact, before Ryan came along, Les's goals had been squirrely built on solid ground. Dusty, arid ground, but still. She'd had dreams of finding her parents with Nico, and living out their days in some honest trade. Her eyes rolled. What a dumb dream. Honest trades on Alaria were very hard to come by. Nico was right. The small items they'd arrived at the shelter with could have come from anywhere. Around those items, the blanket, Nico's baby clothes, the ribbon holding back her riot of curls, the cheap metal bracelet she'd been wearing that no longer fit, she created a fiction, a lovely little farce with no basis in fact. And her brother had finally called her on it. In a very short amount of time, Lessa had lost a father figure who'd blinked in and out of her life so quickly that the sting of it still stole her breath. Her brother no longer needed or wanted her protection, and her lovely little fiction had been snatched away by Oni. She didn't know who she was anymore, just that she wanted things to go back to the way they were before. Though, lately, there was a whisper inside her, a faint suggestion to let go, to stop trying so hard to hold on. But if she let go, what was she left with, exactly? Did she want to be like Ryan, searching for a father she might never find, her life driven and directed by that sole purpose? Did she want to strike off on her own, now that her brother had grown up? And if Cade could die, the Ace of Spades wasn't as safe as she'd thought. Funny how there was a time when Lessa had wanted nothing more than to be on the ship and as far from Alaria as she could get. Nico had been the opposite, demanding to leave the ship and go back to the life he knew. He'd been spitting mad, crewing with a bunch of hard-asses, as he'd called the captain and Cade. But now, Les was sure the very idea of leaving the Ace of Spades wouldn't even cross his mind. They'd come full circle, it seemed. But did she want to leave? A deep sigh escaped her as she sat up. She honestly didn't know. Chapter 16. Ace of Spades, Ivica System, June 2557. Ryan was on the bridge when the Ace of Spades alert system pinged. She turned it off immediately to keep from waking the crew, and stayed in her chair as the sensation of dropping out of slipspace pushed and pulled ever so slightly on her body. A quick check of her FTL showed the engine in excellent working order. Should be. She'd paid enough for it. A few distant stars peppered the viewscreen as Ace slowed to subluminal speed. Ryan pulled up the star chart of Ibicus and used the navigational software to pinpoint their location within the system. Not too far off course. They dropped out only a few hours' journey from Garanose. "Good girl, Ace," she murmured, plotting a course correction into the nav system. All things considered, it was a decent drop. Ryan relaxed in her chair and stared at the screen, without putting her focus on any one thing. A full sleep cycle had become foreign these days. She rarely got more than a few hours at a time. Apparently, neither did Ram. He entered the bridge in a t-shirt and baggy pajama bottoms, hair loose to his shoulders, carrying two mugs of Kazba coffee, a splurge in credits due to its import tax, coming all the way from tribute in the inner colonies, but so worth it. He handed her a mug and then moved to the nav panel and pressed a few commands.
Not far now, he said quietly, leaning his hip against the console and staring.